A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So if you want to make yourself comfy on the couch over there, how stretchy are your legs?
They're all right.
I was going to think if
it's
you
good,
want...
No, it's good.
If I can slide that in the middle of them without being weird, and then you can just sit back and...
Lovely.
Enjoy the show.
On silent, it is. Great.
So up top, Ben just mentioned something to me about the... Well, I think the lady who's written my favourite song of the last 10 years around the Christmas period... Santa's coming for us. Can we just start this conversation off with your Sia anecdote?
My Sia anecdote. Way back in 1997, I'm in Japan with a band that I was in after the Almighty split up, a band called Sick, a punk band that I formed in Dublin. Three-piece band. I've been to Japan many times, as the Almighty always did very well there. So we're over doing some shows. Two other guys have never been to Japan before. And we're in Tokyo for a week. And we're just having the best time ever. The shows are sold out and... We're drinking, we're partying, and we end up meeting a couple of Aussie girls who are working as waitresses at this nightclub in Tokyo. And they're great fun, and they end up hanging out with us and partying with us all week, and we sort of see them every day, just having a great laugh, you know, as you do when you're young. And then this one girl says to me and the drummer in the band, she's like, I'm a songwriter, I write songs. And usually when people say that,
oh yeah, here we go. Yeah.
And you know, we really like these girls, and suddenly it's like, oh, you're going to give me something, and it's, you know, it's you're going to, you know what I mean? It's
yeah,
going
of course.
To, it's
yeah,
going
I
to be
it.
Weird. So she hands us a CD, and our drummer goes away and listens to it, and says, hands it to me, and goes, you should have a listen to that, just so you can tell her you've listened to it. And I was like, oh really? So I listened to it, and it's just okay. She's not got a bad voice. Nothing jumped out at me. Didn't think the songs were particularly good. We give her the CD back, and of course, you lie. That's great.
It's fantastic.
It's really,
yeah,
really good.
Yeah.
And then we sort of go away and we snigger and we make a joke going, you know, wow, you know, she's, you know, I'm glad she's not trying to be a musician. I mean, lovely girl. I mean, amazing, amazing girl. I couldn't say enough good things about it. They were so much good fun. It's Sia.
Sia before Sia.
Sia before Sia.
Yeah.
About a year and a half, 2 years later, Sia is everywhere and she mm-hmm. blows up and she is amazing, and fair play to her, because she said, you know, she was like, I'm just doing this, I'm going to work at my music, I'm going to go to London after Tokyo, I'm going to pursue it, and I'm going to do it, and look at her, you know. I just think, what a great story, you know.
And have you seen her
so
since?
Never employ me as your A&R
yeah, right?
guy.
You haven't got a clue.
No.
So did you reconnect after that,
you know,
moment?
I haven't, but I think Gary, who was the drummer at the time, still keeps in touch with her through email.
Amazing.
To this day, you know. So that's just an amazing story, and just shows you.
Yeah, right. And that Christmas track she released was incredible, I thought.
Yeah,
one of my favourite Christmas songs of the last few years.
She's amazing. You know, she obviously had a talent. I mean, I don't think I was ever in doubt, in fairness, with the CD that the girl could sing, but we were just, it was just unremarkable. It was
yeah,
just,
yeah, yeah.
You know,
didn't have that magic.
Yeah, you know. But there you go.
There you go. See it to start us off. So you were born in County Down, right?
Yeah.
66.
66.
Tell us about that place at that time and the cultural landscape as a kid growing up there.
As a kid growing up, you know, when the Troubles really started, I was 3 years old.
Right.
So all through the 70s and into the 80s, I moved to Scotland at the tail end of 1980. that was in full swing, sadly. So I'd never known anything but that. And when you're born into something like that, you just think it's the norm. So I never remember feeling frightened. I never remember, you know, barricades, army on the streets, gunfire, bombs going off. That's just where I lived. And you just got on with it. And people did just get on with it. The people didn't make any fuss about it. And it was too much of, oh, that's just the way it is. Maybe that was a lot of the problem, you know. So when I did get to move to Scotland...
Did your parents want to move to escape that? Was that the
reason? I think that was a big part of it, yeah. Right. Although I think it's kind of funny that at that moment in time in Belfast with all the religious bigotry going on, west of Scotland wouldn't have been my first choice to move to avoid religious bigotry, because there's quite a lot of religious bigotry in west of Scotland, certainly with the two football teams that they have going on there.
Yeah.
And I remember the first day I went to school, I got asked, if, was I Protestant or Catholic? And I was just like, man, I can't escape. I can't escape this.
Were your parents religious?
Yeah, my mom is very religious. Not so much my dad, but my mom was very religious, you know. She was a Sunday school teacher, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, good memories, you know. I don't remember having a bad childhood at all. And I mean, and again, unremarkable. When I was just like a normal kid, I was a bit of a daydreamer. Didn't particularly like school. You know, certainly I remember hearing bombs going off. I remember seeing riots. And I remember just looking at them and not feeling any fear or just, that's just what happens in Belfast, you know, sadly.
I spoke to Dom Jolly, the comedian for this podcast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he grew up in Lebanon, right. Which is obviously, you know, a massive conflict zone at that time as well. Yeah. And he says it certainly like creates a unique psychological makeup within yourself that chaos doesn't frighten you.
No, it didn't hit me until I was in my 20s and I remember being somewhere and suddenly just going, shit, that was a bomb that went off across the street. I could have been killed, you know, and then for having almost like an anxiety attack about it, because I just never really thought about it. And suddenly I was like, wow, well, that was a dead guy on the road that we had to go around on the way to school that morning. You know, that was a, you know, armored car that was driving down our street. It's suddenly you're like, you know, I remember being overwhelmed by it. And then I sort of thought, well, that was just bizarre. You know, and I think it took me to get out of that situation and travel the world for a bit and see relatively normal other cultures, if that exists. Mm. But see that, you know, there wasn't a McDonald's in Belfast in 1994. I mean, we had nothing.
Did bands come through?
Very rarely. I mean, obviously you had the Irish bands playing, like, you know,
Lizzie, Rudy, Stiffle Fingers,
and Rory Gallagher and Horselips and all those great bands, because they were from there, so there was no fear. But very rarely would you get a big band. So what would happen, you would get kids that would go and see Stiff Little Fingers one week, we would go and see Fleetwood Mac the next week, just because a big band is in town.
And when the gigs are happening, are the political and religious differences set aside for the night?
Out the window. You know, it's almost like an unwritten rule that's left behind, and it's we're all one, we're all unified by the music. And
I bet that creates in you then quite a deep appreciation and fascination with music, because that seems to be the only thing without boundaries or borders.
Yeah.
Was that the case for you?
Absolutely. It was a sanctuary, as it were, that you could go there and you could leave all that behind. It didn't matter what part of the town you came from, what church you went to, you know, it didn't matter a fuck. And the kids didn't want to be reminded of that. And certainly when any bands would come over and start trying to preach about it, that didn't go down very well with because the kids are like, we don't want to hear about it. We know. We're living this every day.
Yeah.
This is our one chance for 2 hours to forget about this bullshit, you know? And, you know, that's still the case today in Belfast. I know we have the peace process, but obviously there's certain areas that you still wouldn't go into if you're from, you know, if you're one religion or the other. But I think with music, that's never been an issue, and rightly so.
Were you a punk rock kid? Was that the music of choice for
you?
I was growing up.
I was a bit too reserved and too daydreamer to be the full on punk rock kid till I was maybe older in my teens, 17, 18, and I sort of had the Mohican. But I was sort of 13, 14. I wasn't really sure what it was, because I loved punk and I loved ska and I loved heavy rock. So I kept sort of flitting between the three.
Yeah.
You know?
I love really the t-shirt, by the way.
Thank you.
That's one of the best tunes. I love it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's my favorite.
Dee Dee Ramone, for the people listening, Poison Heart.
Yeah, I actually got this, where Dee Dee's buried is a cemetery in LA called Hollywood Forever.
I've been there.
Yeah, and Dee Dee and
Johnny
are both
there. I went there shortly after Chris Cornell passed away, and his grave was freshly laid.
Yeah. So they have a Day of the Dead festival every year there, you know, which is the Mexican festival, which is great, and everybody dresses up, and you know, there's thousands of people go, and we went this year, and where Dee Dee's buried, they had a huge Dee Dee Ramone merch booth set up, and I thought, I gotta get a t-shirt. And it's kind of funny because
isn't your new guitarist his old guitarist?
His old guitar player, yeah.
He used to be called Creepy Chris.
Creepy
back
Chris,
then, right?
Yeah.
Has he got some stories that he's told you about Dee Dee?
Yeah, he does the best Dee Dee Ramone impersonation ever as well. He's got that down. I think he had a really great time touring with Dee Dee. I think it was pretty eventful, pretty crazy, you know.
I'll bet. I read Marky Ramone's book. The chaos in that band. Like, I never realized how fractured they were. Like, obviously Joey had his severe compulsive thing going on. Obviously Johnny was Johnny. You had Marky, who was just a full-blown alcoholic. Dee Dee was a junkie.
Yeah,
it's amazing that they kind of stayed together for as long as they did.
And then, you know, obviously Johnny and Joey not speaking because of the girlfriend thing.
Yes, just did it for,
I know. And they toured. They never really took it. I don't think they ever took a tour bus out once. It was all done in a van and a truck.
So it's like a microcosm of pressure,
I can't,
isn't it?
I can imagine the tension must have been unbearable. But we, the Almighty, we supported the Ramones.
Really? One of the many.
One of our first ever tour.
I want to get to some of the incredible bands that you toured with the Almighty.
Yeah.
I guess we'll start with the Ramones as we're on them.
Yeah, I mean, that was phenomenal because we all love the Ramones so much. And I'll never forget it. They were really great to us, especially their crew were super sweet to us because we were very nervous. And we were just very much like, you know, watching them every night, but you know, we didn't speak to them the first week, and Johnny's like, "Hey, fuck's up with you guys? Is there a problem here?" And we're like, "No, why you guys ain't talking to us? You know, what's your problem?" And we're like, "You know, you're the Ramones, you know, fuck that, man, come on, you know." And then for the last sort of 10 days of the tour, it was just, you know, we were hanging out with them the whole time, and they couldn't have been nicer. I mean, we never saw, if there was any friction, we never saw any of that at all. And it was CJ Ramone's first tour. DD just left the band, so it was CJ's first run.
I've had CJ on the show as well, and he told me about
still friends with CJ now, you know.
An amazing guy.
Yeah.
And he was telling me the story about how Epitaph really wanted to sign them.
Right.
Because, you know, everybody thinks of the Ramones as this hugely successful band.
Yep.
But in fact, in their lifetime, they really weren't, were they? It's only sort of posthumously.
Yep.
That people
Absolutely.
Have learned to appreciate them, and you know, the logo is obviously, you know, a synonymous kind
of course.
Fashion icon now, but they never made much money off record sales.
Nope.
And they had to just hustle for years,
which is
their
why
whole
they
life, didn't they?
Constantly, you know, and cheaply. Yeah, I mean, I think they did quite well touring, but they weren't making the money I think that people thought they were making.
You know? How many songs would they play in a night?
Oh, it was amazing. I think there was like 32, 32 in the set, and the set was like an hour and 10 minutes long, if that, you know what I mean?
Incredible.
Yeah, it was great. That was one of those tours where somebody said, that's it, that's all you're getting. I'd have gone, okay, I got the one for the Ramones. Can't really argue with that.
But there was plenty more.
Well, the very next
Motorhead, right?
The next one was Motorhead, and it was like, does it get any better, you know? And it does, yeah. It was Motorhead, which for me was just the ultimate, you know. And they just made a brilliant album, the 1916 album.
Yes.
So it was a big comeback album for them. It was a lot.
Yeah, because they sort of dipped, didn't they, for a while.
In the late 80s, yeah. And they came back really strongly. They had a new record deal, a new album. Lemmy was just moved to America. He was looking good. He was enjoying life. And they were kind of one of their peaks back then. And again, they couldn't have been nicer to us. And Lemmy was so gracious and funny and would hang out all the time. And, you know, the crew was wonderful to us. And it was just a great tour for us to be on, you know.
I've heard that Lemmy had one of those kind of really sharp wits.
Very
just
dry.
One of the funniest dudes.
Didn't suffer fools.
Yeah.
Very comfortable being Lemmy. Very funny. Very clever. Very educated. Very astute. You know, a lot more, I think people didn't give him enough credit for that. He was a very clever man, and I just loved him. I just thought he was brilliant. He was so nice to me and sweet to me and just great, you know. I can't say anything else about the guy, you know.
Did you cut loose with him?
fuck yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was mental. You know, I tried to keep up with Lemmy a couple of times and it's ended in disaster, you know?
My favorite Lemmy story that I heard is from a guy who came to pick him up. I can't remember whether I heard it on a podcast or through a friend of a friend, but the tour manager came to pick him up for tour.
Yeah.
And he opens the door and Lemmy's just there in like underpants, t-shirt. And he's like, Lem, like we're going on tour for like 3 months, man. Like, come on, get ready. And he's like, okay. Puts his trousers on and stuff, walks out the door. And the guy's like, Lem, we're going on tour. He's like, you need to pack some things. He goes, I got you. Goes back inside, picks up an orange. He's like, right, let's go. That's fucking
brilliant.
Orange.
That is brilliant. I'll tell you my favorite Lemmy story, and there's been many with him. I'll try and do a shorter version of this. We'd done that tour, and then there was used to have a convention every year in the States called the Concrete Foundation Forum, and lots of bands would play at it. The Almighty were booked to play at it, and so were Motorhead, and Lem's like, when you get to America, give us a show. We're staying in the same hotel. So I get checked in, just got off the plane, 10-hour flight, jet lag, doesn't matter. You know, Lem's got in touch and said, you know, I'm in this room, left a message at reception, come up to the room as soon as you get here. It's not fucking jet lagged, you know, and... No, I'm sorry. This is right before the tour with them. This is before we went on tour with them. This is Gary's crew. So I go up to the room and it's brilliant. He opens the door and it's like a scene from a movie. There's just all this smoke and this light behind him, you know, and he's got the fucking tidy tight shorts on and the cowboy hat and the damn cut off, open the chest out. And it's just a smoke and aura, like a god, you know what I mean? I'm like, hey, Lem, he's like, come in, you know, and Phil Campbell's in the room and his room's full of people. There's girls there and his, you know, he says, sit down. So I sit down and he goes, you all right? I went, oh, yeah, I'm fine. He goes, I've just got mixing of the new album. Do you want to hear it? And I went, I'd love to hear it. Sorry if this people don't think it's a very good Lemmy impersonation. It's the best.
I think you're doing pretty good.
So he sits me down. He goes, hold this. And he hands me a pint glass. And he fills it 3/4 of the way with Jack Daniels and about a quarter of Coca-Cola in it. Two or three ice cubes. I think it was three. I always remember thinking, there's three ice cubes in this. This is really weird, you know? And then he racks me out one of the biggest lines of something. Could have been speed, could have been coke, could have been embalming fluid. I don't know what it was, but it was a tram line. And he puts his headphones on me and he goes, drink that, snort that, and listen to that. Right? So I've got these headphones on. I'm trying to keep up with him. I do this line, you know, carnage going on in the room. I'm just going, this is the best day ever. You know, this is fucking great. New Motorhead album's pumping in my ears. It's wonderful. He's topping me up. I think he racks out another line. I do it. I'm out of my mind. I'm listening to Motorhead, hanging with Lemmy and Phil Campbell in his hotel room. The album finishes and Lemmy kind of looks at me, raises the eyebrow. He goes, what do you think? And I stand up to tell him what I think. My legs give way. And I fall. I smash the pint glass and throw up at the same time and cut my eye. And I'm lying on the carpet and... in my sort of own snot and vomit, and I can sort of smell this rancid breath and hear this breathing above my left ear, and the room spinning. And he goes, Warwick, he goes, you're a fucking lightweight. You'll never last the tour. And it's just brilliant, you know.
That is class.
Warwick, you're a fucking lightweight. And I was, you know.
So that was your initiation into the Motorhead
camp.
Yeah,
you know.
And you passed with flying colours.
I think I passed. You know, I think my spectacular ending was not on the cards, but I think they thought, you know, I just never remember Lemmy right in my face, Warwick, you're a lightweight.
That's fucking incredible. How was the Donington Monsters of Rock in 92? Was it the year you guys did?
It was, yeah.
Iron Maiden, Wasp, Slayer.
That was amazing. As I'd been there a fan only 4 years earlier, the year that Maiden headlined it with Guns on the bill, when there was 125,000 people there, I got the overnight bus down with my girlfriend at the time from Glasgow.
This is pre-Almighty, is it even?
We just started the Almighty. Just literally started the Almighty, and remember standing there going, I want to be on that stage. 4 years later, I'm on that stage. And, you know, it's and the irony wasn't lost on me, and I knew what a big opportunity it was. I knew it was ours to screw up, or it was ours to grasp and elevate the band. And just all of us were totally determined. What I remember about it that day, more than anything else, apart from the gig being so great, was my dad's 61st birthday. And my dad's always been a big supporter of my music. And I flew him down. And, you know, my dad's this real Ulster man. He came down with a suit and a tie on, dressed impeccably, you know. And he liked this whiskey, you know. And he arrived, and I sort of gave him his pass and showed him where everything was. And I think after he drank most of our rider, he ended up in Skid Row's dressing room. And I have this image. And Rachel and I are still friends this day. Rachel would always ask about my dad right up until he passed away. Him and Rachel with their arms around each other, you know, and a bottle of whiskey, hammered, hanging out together, you know. And Rachel, your dad's way cooler than you. You know, he's the best guy ever. And blah blah blah. And that's the best memory I have of that day, I think, you know.
That's incredible. Yeah. When you get to share stuff like that with your family, and as you say, you can leave them on their own,
yeah,
and they can just make all the friends like outstage, yeah, you on the rock scale. Even
well,
like,
my dad was an incredible class guy. He just loved it, you know. He was a very blue collar, straight up, you know, everything, there's no grey area with him. He knew where he stood, very honest type kind of guy. But he was very supportive of what I did. And I mean, this is brilliant. When he passed away 4 years ago, and he was cremated, and as he was going into the, you know, into the crematorium, he wanted Free and Easy played.
Wow.
And Free and Easy was blasting as my dad's coffin's going into the flames, you know. And I just, like, this is, and I'm just, I mean, I'm bawling, but I'm laughing. I'm just laughing so much to myself, just going, what a dude, you know, what a guy, you know.
Proud,
I mean,
dad, man.
Yeah, it's just brilliant, you know.
That tune's amazing as well.
Thank you very
was
much.
Was that album produced by Andy Taylor?
It certainly was,
from,
yes,
Duran Duran. Now, yeah, I wouldn't have put him down as the rock guy. Yeah. What made you want to work with him?
Well, he is. That's the thing. That's what people don't know about Andy. Obviously, huge in Duran Duran, the Power Station stuff as well, which I loved, which is, you know, obviously a bit more rockier. Andy's a Geordie, brought up in Lizzie, brought up in DC. When he was 14, 15, he went out and toured all the military bases all over Germany, which is, you know, kind of like what the Beatles were doing in Hamburg.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
know,
yeah.
So he learned his chops very young, and he's a phenomenal guitar player and a great singer. And he just done Backstreet Symphony for Thunder.
Oh, okay.
We loved the production on that record. And so when we were talking about producers for the second album, we were like, you know, we'd really like to get Andy Taylor to do it because we like what he did with Thunder.
They were on the bill that year at Donington
as
well, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So that's the reason we got Andy in to do it. And, you know, I'm still friends with, I've just written, Andy's about to put a lot of new material out next year, and I've co-written about 7 songs with him.
Nice. So you're a busy man, aren't you?
I am a busy man.
You never stop.
I never stop, yeah.
There's so many people that I've had on this show that you are clearly good friends with and have worked with as,
yeah,
well. Ginger Wildheart.
Of course.
I wanted to chat to you about Andy Cairns,
yeah,
from Therapy.
Yeah.
A good friend of mine. I love that man. And he asked me, well, first of all, he said to say hello.
Yep.
I spoke to him last night. I was like, I'm speaking to Ricky
brilliant
tomorrow. Give me some pointers. And he goes, ask him about his birthday in 95 at the Rebel Studios, is it? When,
yeah,
we were recording Infernal Love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can we go there?
Oh, we can go there. I can't remember a lot about it. Andy's been a really good friend of mine since about 92. Obviously, we're both from Northern Ireland, so, you know, we clicked straight away.
Yeah.
But obviously, a lot of the same musical tastes. I'm a huge Therapy fan. And, you know, at a sort of difficult, very difficult year or two in my life, sort of 98, 99, and Andy was very much there for me as a friend and helped me tremendously get myself back together and sort myself out. You know, regardless of the music, he was there as a friend, and I owe him a lot for that. And we've just been great friends. Same sense of humour, you know, same stupidity, same love of bands. So he's a dear friend. But they were recording Infernal Love in Real World Studios, which is Peter Gabriel's place. I was living in London at the time, and they'd take weekends off, and Andy would be like, right, weekends off. And I'd jump on the train and arrive down on a Friday night, and we just party for the whole weekend. And I remember one particular birthday, we were just out of our minds, and we went in, there was a kitchen, you know, with the chefs. It was a live-in studio, it's a beautiful studio. And we put the chef's gear on and thought it would be a good idea to take out this canoe into this lake that's there. So we got an old... the old tape recorder, and we decided we were going to go out and record these ducks and write this album called Duck Symphony, which was these ducks quacking with these heavy real death metal heavy guitars. And of course, being as out of our minds we were deadly serious about this at the time. And we got as far as sitting, there's a picture of us sitting in the canoe with the tape recorder trying to get these ducks to fucking quack in the tape recorder so we could go back in and start making Duck Symphony, which was going to, you know, blow people's minds, you know. So there you go. That was one of the stories.
Well, he's given me a few more pointers, but
right,
we'll come back to them.
No
after
problem.
The Donington tour, is that how you got the Maiden tour after that show? Did they kind of spot you guys and take note then, or did it come through another way? And how did they treat you, and how was that experience?
It was a bet. I got on Donington. I won a bet with Steve Harris. And Maiden were having... Steve was a big...
Steve is and was a big fan of the Almighty and a great supporter of the band. But Iron Maiden were having an album launch party or something, I can't remember what it was for, and the theme was sideshow stalls, like circus side, like, you know, throw a ball, knock over the coconut, darts, whatever you have. And one of them was a football net, football goals, with a thing down with, you've got to kick the ball through the hole and you get so many points at different holes. And I'm not a bad football player, so I was doing it with Steve. And Steve's watching me, he says, right, if you get that one in the top corner, you're on Donington. I went, all right, boom, right through, shook my hand. Rod Smallwood calls up our manager on the Monday, the Almighty on Donington. So I like to think it was a bet that I got us on Donington.
Amazing.
You know, yeah, that's a true story. But hey, listen, you know, I think we might have got it anyway, because the band was very much on the up and there was a buzz about the band, and it just seemed natural that we were the band of that year to be on that bill, because that was our time. But that's officially how I got it, was a football bet.
And I mean, they're just about as high a level of operators in the entertainment world, not just rock and metal, but their live show and their tours are traveling circuses, aren't they?
Yeah.
What's it like to get a kind of a vantage point from behind the scenes and step into that world? And what do you learn from a band like that?
Well, I think you just realize how meticulous it's run, how passionate their fans are. You know, I mean, their fans are just so committed and so loyal. And that was amazing for me to see. And we built up a good fan base at that point, and we had that as well. But to see it when it's 20,000 people a night that are that, I don't think I've ever seen anything that, it was almost like a football game, you know, where you've got 20,000 soccer fans so passionate about their team. So that blew me away. But again, they couldn't have been nicer to us. They treated us exceptionally well. And it was just great. I remember going into that tour when we ended up touring and being very nervous, because it was the first tour where I kind of thought, I don't know how we're going to go down with our fans because they're so hardcore.
Yeah.
Will they even care?
Them and AC/DC have to be two of the hardest bands to
open for. We never played with AC/DC. I would have loved to have toured AC/DC, but that never happened. But we went down well with Maiden, you know, and really well. So that was an amazing tour for us, and that really catapulted the band, you know, not just in the UK but in Europe, certainly up a few rungs on the ladder, you know.
I mean, there was a period where you guys were absolutely killing in UK and Europe. Did it ever happen in the States? Did you ever try and get out there?
We tried. We did 1 9-week tour there. It nearly killed us. You know, we had a lot of action at rock radio with pretty much the first three albums. Then, you know, the old cliche, label problems. Our guy would always seem to be getting sacked. We'd built up a rapport. We're about to do something and the guy would be fired and everything would be put on.
And you're down at the bottom of the list again.
You start again, a new guy would come in. But that time, the moment was all that shit. That happened on all three records. Power Tripping, we did a 9-week club tour. And, you know, outside of the sort of East Coast and West Coast, the main hubs, it was here we are in the middle of, you know, Nebraska playing to three people. Here we are in Kentucky playing to five people. And it was hard. You know, it was hard because we were touring in a van, driving 700-800 miles every day, setting up, playing, staying in a crappy Motel 6, getting up at 7, driving 3 months. And even when you're in your 20s, that was still hard. And, you know, I think it nearly, at that time, it nearly split the band up. I think only the success we were having in Europe kept us together, you know.
Did you ever tour with any of the grunge bands? Because Power Tripping was obviously a very grunge-influenced album.
We did.
Did you ever get on bills with those
kinds
of groups?
Yeah, we toured with Alice in Chains. And we did a tour with Alice in Chains and Megadeth in 92, right before grunge blew up, and Alice in Chains actually opened that tour.
In the States was this?
It was in the UK.
In the UK.
And Europe. And Alice in Chains were first on. We were in the middle, and then Megadeth. And it was a brilliant tour. And I remember seeing Alice in Chains, and it just hadn't exploded yet. And I thought they were amazing straight away. I just was like, fuck, this is incredible. You know, this is amazing music. But half the crowd was divided. Half the crowd was really into it, and half the crowd was like, boo, this is rubbish. It's not heavy metal. And it was a really extreme reaction. And usually I find when you have that from a crowd, the band's going to be huge. If they
right.
make that much.
Yeah, yeah.
The other
that.
Band I've seen is The Darkness.
Oh, man. Well, the Wild Hearts took them out, didn't they, super early on?
Yeah, but I Def Leppard did as well. And I was solo opening acoustic on that tour. So I was watching The Darkness every night.
That's and before they blew up, is
before
it?
Before they blew up on the first EP. And again, the crowd was divided. You know, half the crowd's booing, you know, what are you, blah, blah,
they think
blah,
it's
blah.
A joke, yeah.
And the other half's going, this is genius. And it's that extreme.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, I said, they're going to be huge. Because they're evoking such... It's not like... The worst thing is indifference. They're all right. I mean, that's... I'd rather have somebody throwing shit at me and going, you suck. And
any kind of reaction, right?
Because that's there's a reaction. Yeah.
Passion in that reaction, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah. So anyway, long answer to your question. Yes, we did. Alice in Chains.
Well, you mentioned your friend Joe Elliott there.
Yeah.
Did you guys buddy up when you moved to Dublin? Yeah. Is that where that friendship begins?
Straight away. Right off the bat.
I love Joe.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't love Joe? It's his birthday tomorrow as well.
Is it really?
Yeah, he's sick, turns a big 6-0 tomorrow.
Amazing.
Yeah, we met. We were rehearsing with the band Sick. I was in After the Almighty. We rehearsed in a place called The Factory. It was a big rehearsal facility in Dublin. And Bowie was in there rehearsing. And he'd been in there for like 6 months rehearsing an album. And being the amazing guy that he is, sorry, it was, sadly, he decided he wanted to put a gig on. And he invited everybody that rehearsed in The Factory, the staff, the whole thing. Because he had a huge room where he was rehearsing. And obviously Joe, being the Bowie nut that he is, had got an invite. And we just went along, and my first meeting with Joe was pretty cool, actually. He's at the bar, and I go up to get a drink, and he tells me, Sean goes, yo, you're Ricky White from The Almighty. I was like, fucking Joe Elliott knows who I am. I went, you're Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, you know? And I had it's just one of those dumb things. I had a couple of Ecstasy tablets on me, and I went, do you want an Ecstasy tablet? And he went, oh, I've never done that before. I said, all right, we'll just do half. So me and him did a half E. That's within the first 30 seconds of meeting him, you know? So we're on these half Ecstasy tablets, and we just start talking. We start talking about football, and he goes, oh, these are rather good. I'm hungry, you know. And we have a great night. That's it. And he says to me, yeah, next is Friday night. There's a game on. Would you like Chinese food? I went, yeah. He says, right, I'll give you a call. Come up Friday night and we'll watch the game. And I go home and, you know, come down and go to bed and go, did that actually just happen? He's never going to phone me. He just said that to be nice. Sure enough, Thursday evening. Right, 7 o'clock, Chinese. Here's the address. I go up to Joe's, and that was it. You know, friendship's born. And again, he's been such a brilliant friend to me over the years, and still is in every way. And I always really cherish his advice. You know, if I'm second guessing something, I'm not sure, I'll go to Joe with a lot of the music that I'm involved in, you know, because I really value his opinion. And he'll tell me the truth.
Yeah, because he's straight up like that.
Straight up.
Did he produce your first solo album?
He produced the first two.
First two?
Yeah.
And I think I heard you on the Danko Jones podcast, another previous guest on here, all these similarities.
Danko's a great guy as
well. He's a lovely man. Yeah. And I think you were talking to him in that about how Joe was the person that really coaxed the singer out of you and was sort of saying, you know, you've done the kind of the shouting and the wailing with the Almighty and the big rock stuff.
Yeah.
I want to hear you sing now. Was he part of that process for you finding your voice?
That's exactly what he said, more or less what you just said to me. You know, I'd moved to Dublin and Sick hadn't really developed into anything, and I took that really bad. I took that really personally and really badly, and kind of went into like a downward spiral for about a year and wasn't in a good place. And Joe Elliott and Andy Cairns and another couple of people in Dublin were really amazing to me and giving me the kick up the backside, going, you know, pull yourself together, get yourself out of this rut.
So were you thinking at that point about just walking away from music?
Oh, I had walked away. I hadn't picked up a guitar in 6-7 months. I hate it. You know, I talked myself into believing that I hated music, although I didn't. I was so done with it and everything that went with it. And yet I'm hanging out with Joe, and Joe would be, and Joe's so passionate, you know, and I'm kind of going, well, it's easy for you. You're in one of the biggest bands in the world. I said, I'm about to hit 30 and off a record deal, not a management deal, don't have a publishing deal, and I don't really know what I'm doing. You know, but Joe kept on at me, and so did Andy, just saying, you just start writing some songs. And Joe said, you know, why don't you pick up an acoustic and just strip it down? And that's what I did. And then, you know, as luck would have it, you know, the Almighty back catalogue gets reverted back to me. I meet a guy in the gym in Dublin who knows it is. He works for Peer Music, who are a great publishing company. He cuts me a check for the Almighty back catalogue, which is, you know, more money I'd seen in 2 years. And I'm back in the music industry, you know. And Joe's like, you got some money? Let's go up to my place. Let's start making a record. And that's what we did. We made Tattoos and Alibis, which was, you know, a game changer and a life changing record for me. And Joe was very much, he says, look, you can sing. He says, I know you can sing. He says, you've done the Almighty. He says, people know what that stands for. He said, sing. And that's where Scott Gorham, Scott came over and played on that record.
So that's how you two met?
And that's, well, I met Scott before then. Scott's wife used to work with my ex-wife at MTV. So I met Scott literally way back in 1991. And Scott came over and played on this record. And he heard me singing for the first time. So he'll tell you when he, you know, offered me the Lizzie gig, a lot of people, well, that guy from the Almighty, he can't sing, he just shouts. Scott, you know, there's people handed from a slow record. Scott had heard the solo record and knew exactly what I could do. and the timbre in my voice and the whole thing and all that. So, yeah.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And, you know, obviously I'm sure you've been asked about this part of the journey 100 times more, but the call, the invitation to join that group,
yeah.
How does that present itself and how do you process that offer?
I'm still processing it 10 years later. I had somebody sort of told me a heads up that my name had been bandied about and I was going to get a call from Scott. Now Scott would, I would talk to Scott every maybe once a year or something, just, hey, how's it going? Everybody well? That kind of thing. And I thought, nah, he's not going to phone. They're going to give it to somebody else. I'm not going to be the guy that's going to be asked to be the singer or anything, is he? And then lo and behold, January morning, I'm at home and the phone goes. And it's Scott. And he's like, hey, everybody. And I thought, is he going to ask me the question? And then at the end of the conversation, I'm putting Lizzie back together. I think you'd be the right guy to sing. What do you think? And I just went, I'm in.
And zero then, reservation, zero doubt.
I didn't even think about it. I went, I'm in. And then my head started spinning. And I don't really remember the rest of the conversation. Scott started talking to me about how he wanted to present the band and his vision for this lineup of Thin Lizzy. And I put the phone down. First thing I did was call my wife. And she was thrilled. And I said, and then at this point I'm starting to go, but it's Phil. I can't do that. You know, and she said, look, she'd do it. She says, if it doesn't feel right at any point, just stop. And I went, okay. So that was her. And then the second person on the phone was a guy called Del James. He's a Thin Lizzy fanatic. Del works for Guns N' Roses, looks after Axl.
I know that dude.
Do you know Del?
He's one of the most fascinating individuals ever. I don't know him, but I know of him because he's like a journalist, a filmmaker,
writer,
tour manager. Yeah. Because wasn't he the guy that he did a short story or something that they based the whole November Rain?
I wrote a couple of songs in Soul Destruction with him.
Wow.
So I've known Del for years.
So he is a multi-talented individual.
Great dude, great friend of mine, Lizzie Nutt. And I knew he would tell me the truth. And I told him what had happened. I said, Del, whatever you tell me, I'm going to do. I said, because that's how much I trust you. Because you will know, nobody loves Lizzie more than you, that I know. And he just said, you absolutely have to do this. And I went, okay, put the phone down. And then you start going, how am I going to do this? Because like I was a Lizzie Nut. It was something, you know, when you're a kid, you dream of singing in your favorite band.
You practice doing it, right? That's not how you envisage yourself. Yeah,
that's
learning
not a reality for me. And I thought, how do I do this? And I thought, I just do this as honestly, respectfully, and as good as I possibly can. What would I want to hear? How would I want to hear those songs? Would I want to hear a different slant on them? I went, no, I'd want to hear those songs as close to the original as they could possibly be. And I said, that's how I'm going to do it, but I said, I'm going to do it respectfully. Because one of the first things I said to Scott was like, do you want me to play bass? Do you want me to play bass and sing? And he said, no, I don't want to present it that way. He said, out of respect for Phil, he said, I want to present it with you singing and we'll get a bass player. He said, I want it, you know, and I thought that was brilliant. You know, he doesn't want a clone. He doesn't want a guy, you know, with dark skin playing the bass. You know, Scott was enough to realize that to respect the songs and respect the legacy and present it in a different way, but still do the music and the songs justice. And I thought that was really, really cool, you know. And took a little bit of the pressure off as well.
And how was that first rehearsal?
Terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, because I knew it was mine to screw up. I knew there was nobody else auditioning. The gig was mine if I wanted it. So I just had to come in and be decent in the first rehearsal. And thankfully I was. And, you know, Brian and Scott said, that's it, we're done. Not as terrifying as the first gig.
I'll bet. And yeah. you had Marco Mendoza, right?
From yeah, with Marco
Twisted
there.
Sister.
Yeah, Brian Downey on drums, obviously. Darren on keyboards. Vivian Campbell from Def Leppard. And obviously Scotty.
So it's all those elements as well. You're like, you're with an all-star, legendary lineup of guys.
And the first gig's Aberdeen, Scotland, who are going to let you know what they think of you in no uncertain terms.
Was it nice to have it in Scotland, though? Did that kind of feel at home turf to you? Or was that not even on your mind? It was just bigger than that.
You know, because I think what was on my mind was the next night was Glasgow.
Right.
And obviously that is home turf, having lived there and the Almighty being from there. That was the one I was concerned about the most. And, so Aberdeen, I mean... I knew the songs inside out. I'd done all my homework. The rehearsals had been great. But I'm just terrified. What are people going to fucking think? Am I going to do it justice? And a mate of mine said to me a great thing. He said to me, he said, no matter what happens, he says, tomorrow, he says, your life's never going to be the same again. Either in a good way or a bad way. And I was kind of like, all right, I think that's a compliment. Cheers, you know. And we started the set with Are You Ready? And we're behind this big kabuki. And ideas, we come on in, we play. The kabuki would drop. We'd come out, are you ready? And I'm standing beside Scott, and my leg's just going like that, like shaking. And he's like, it'll be okay, bud. And I wanted to fucking punch him. I wanted to punch him and go, what the fuck have you got me into? I mean, I was that angry, you know? I'm nearly in tears. I'm so nervous. Of course, it drops, lights come up, and you start. And the best thing about that tour, which I think is brilliant, first three songs, everybody's just sort of, and you can see everybody just going, is this guy any good? Am I liking this? Is this, or should I be liking this? Is it okay to like this? And by the fourth song, people were suddenly getting into it. By the end of the set, place is going crazy, you know? And it was like that every night because people were seeing it for the first time. But what was great about it was we did Aberdeen, and Aberdeen sold out on the day. And there was still three or four shows on the tour that didn't sell out. And I remember the promoter phoning up Adam Parsons, our manager, going, have you seen these tickets? And Adam's like, well, what's going on? He says, every show sold out after the first show.
Because word was out.
Because word, you know, the internet, it spread. And people vote with their feet. That's the way I look at it. So, you know, that was a testimony to the Lizzie faithful. And, you know, obviously it gave me a real shot in the arm as well, the fact that, you know, people were liking it. You know, because that's all you want. You just want people to like it, you know?
What was your favourite song to play on guitar, and what was your favourite song to sing, and were they the same? First initial tour where you're just fully seeped and immersed in it?
Playing Emerald on guitar is amazing. I love singing Jailbreak. It's a great song to sing. I just love that song. I'll never start playing that song, ever. That riff, but, you know.
When you make the decision to start writing new material, is there ever a thought that you're going to call it Lizzie still?
There is, yeah.
There is?
Yeah.
Are people in the camp divided over that? And how do you make the choice to rebrand, as it were, and go with a different name?
I think we were victims of the success of the live thing and not really taking a breath, because the next, suddenly you get a bit cocky and you think, right, we should write some songs.
Yeah. And you're all enjoying it.
We're
and you're
having a great buzz.
Energy's flowing.
Everybody seems to be loving it. And it just seemed like the natural thing to do. And it's funny because Damon and I were kind of waiting for Scott and Brian to sort of take direction in the songwriting, and it never happened. So I kind of looked at Damon and went, look, you're a songwriter in your other band. I'm a songwriter. Maybe we should get the ball rolling and write a couple of songs and take it to them. So we did, and they loved them. And we just kept writing more songs and giving them to Scott and Brian, and they're going, this is great. We end up doing some demos. Our management take the demos out, send them out, and there's phenomenal interest. Of course there is, because it's the first time Thin Lizzy are going to be making new music in 30 years. And there's 8 or 9 record deals on the table. Everything's great. We've got studio time booked. We've got Kevin Shirley lined up to produce the record. And then I think the penny drops. Hang on a minute. That we're making a new Lizzy album in 30 years without Phil. this is a step too far. And I think everybody was feeling it. I know I was. I felt like I was under tremendous pressure, and I felt like it could go, it could really backfire badly against us, because the life thing was going well, and a lot of people had accepted the life thing. My heart's telling me this is wrong. This is the wrong thing to do. This is sacrilege. Shouldn't be doing this. Be going here. So my head's going, your name's going to be on a Thin Lizzy record. That's going to be amazing. You know, so I had that whole conflict going on. And then when Scott came in, I said, look, second thoughts, I was relieved, very relieved. And it was absolutely the right decision. And at that point, it just brought up a couple of things. We've been touring fairly constantly for 2.5 years. Brian, at that point, you know, we had these songs, and I just immediately said, we're not wasting these songs. I said to Scott, let's just change our name and record an album so we can put these songs out. Scott's like, killer, I'm in. You know, Damon took a bit of convincing. Damon was like, I don't know if I want to start another band. And because we'd all been through it before. And I talked Damon into it. Marco was up for it. Brian and Darren were sort of at that point going, we don't really want to start from ground zero. Well, it wasn't ground zero, but you know what I mean? Go through the whole thing. So they stepped aside. Jimmy DeGrasso comes in. A couple of the labels were like, oh, if you're not calling it Thin Lizzy.
I was going to ask you that. If you decide to go with a different name, do all of a sudden those 9 offers go down to 4?
They do. And the main reason we went with Nuclear Blast is Monty Connor, who signed us, was a no Phil, no Lizzy guy. Didn't want to entertain the idea of Lizzy carrying on with another singer. And I get that. I don't have any ill will towards these people at all. I totally understand their point of view and understand why they think that. And that's okay. Monty was in that camp. We sent the demos to Mark Palmer at Nuclear Blast here, and Mark was blasting them in his office, and Monty walked past and stopped, and he went, they're the new Thin Lizzy demos, aren't they? And Mark went, yep. He went, really fucking good. And it's a testimony to Monty. Monty puts an offer in, and when we decided, we told the labels to change the name, obviously, like I said, 4 or 5 withdrew straight away. Nuclear Blast said, we really love these songs. Obviously, we're not going to offer you as much money as if it were Thin Lizzy, because right out of the gate, it would, no matter how it sounded, just because the name's on it, it would have been so much interest. But he said, we do want to be involved. And he still made us a really good deal, enough to be able to go and record with Kevin Shirley in the studio we wanted and make all hell breaks loose, which is what we did. You know, so that's how we end up being on Nuclear Blast to this day.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
What a story. And the creativity just hasn't stopped. Like,
yeah.
Pretty much every couple of years there's been a new album. The two that followed, who was the producer who made those two? Nick?
Nick Naskalinich.
I can't get my head around his surname.
It's
but
a tricky one to
remember. He's like more of a heavy dude, isn't he? Mastodon, Deftones.
Yeah.
Alice in Chains.
Yeah, Foo Fighters.
How come he was the guy?
Well, we initially wanted to do the second record. Joe was going to produce it.
Right.
And we were going to do it in Dublin with Joe and Ronan McHugh, who does all the Leopard stuff and did my solo records. And that was a done deal. Joe had come out and met us. We talked about the record. We were all very excited. Leopard were off the road. And then Leopard got a bunch of offers in for shows he just couldn't turn down. And Joe was just like, I'm really sorry. You know, I have to go and do these shows. I'm going to have to withdraw from the album. And we're like, shit, who are we going to get to produce it? And Damon had just moved to Nashville and met Nick Raskolnicz at an Iron Maiden gig. And said, look, I'm pretty friendly with Nick Raskolnicz. You know, Grammy winner in the war. But just he said, I don't know if he'll do it. I don't know if he'll do it for the money we have, but I'll ask him. So Damon reached out to Nick, and Nick said he was interested but wanted to see us play live. As fate would have it, we were on tour. We played Nashville a couple of weeks later. Nick came down to the show, saw the band, loved the band, agreed to do the record, you know? And at that point, Marco just left as well, so Robbie Crane had just come in and, you know.
With this latest album, because it seems to me from the outside looking in, perhaps this is true, that the writing partnership for those first three was pretty much you and Damon, is that safe to say?
Yeah.
Mainly?
Yeah.
He's no longer in the group, right?
Yeah.
So how does that change the writing process for this latest album?
It doesn't, you know, and that's no disrespect to Damon, is that I can write songs on my own, and I can finish songs on my own, and I love to do that. But I also love being in a situation where I have an idea, and instead of finishing it, I'll take it to somebody else because I want their input, and I enjoy that.
It's the whole collaborative process of songwriting.
You know what I mean? And I would take various ideas to Damon. Sometimes they were nearly finished and they wouldn't change that much. But Damon and I had this agreement that we'd just split around 50-50 because we were so nervous when we started writing with the whole Lizzy thing. It was like, you know, we were just like, okay, me and you'll do it. We'll just
share the burden, as it were.
Exactly. Well put. So that didn't change. I was still writing a lot of stuff, but I would just take them to Christian.
Yeah.
Who's a great songwriter.
And he's from Stone Sour, is that right? Yeah, as well Stone as Dee Dee?
Yeah. So he, there was just, all I'm doing is taking it to a guy with a different personality and different vibe, but I'm still taking, getting the songs to a point. It was even, I think there's even three or four in this record that I just wrote the whole thing while we were waiting to find a guitar player because I had the song. So there's three where it's just me on the record.
And you got a new drummer on this album as well, right?
Yeah, who'd been in the band for 2 years, but this was the first time he recorded an album. So the process didn't really change. Christian was great. Scott still brings in his riffs and we'll give them to me and I'll take them away. And
when he comes to you with a riff, is it still like, fuck, how does he keep doing it? Is he one of those guys?
He doesn't bring in many riffs. I wish he'd bring in more. But the ones he brings in...
solid gold every time.
Amazing. You know, he brought one in. You know, typical Scotty is like, I've got all the lyrics written. All the songs are done. They're all demoed. I meet him the night before we start recording. He's like, hey, bud, check this out. And I was like, you're not going to give me a song. We're starting the album tomorrow, mate. You know, please. And he gives me this song, which is a finished musical demo. And it's brilliant, you know. And of course, I stay up to 3 o'clock that night writing the lyric. The song's called Underneath the Afterglow, and it makes it on the record. And it's a great song, you know. So he brings in quality when he brings in those. They're just, the riffs are just amazing, you know.
And what about Jay Rushton? Because he is Steel Panthers guy.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
I did a tour with them in February and they're just the funniest
fucking dudes in the
world.
They're good dudes.
What else has he done aside from them?
He's done a lot of Anthrax stuff.
Right, right.
He's done the Donnas. He's done a lot of pop.
Oh, wow.
Done a lot of pop stuff. Mixed a bunch of stuff.
Had your time with Nick just kind of run its course?
Well, Jay had mixed both our albums, Killer Instinct and Heavy Fire. He'd mixed them, so I knew him. And he was very keen to produce the band, do the whole thing. And just with the lineup changes and sort of the whole shift in energy, we just were like, right, we need to, maybe it's time to work with somebody else.
New chapter.
We've got new guys coming in, new blood. They're bringing in new sound, new attitude. Let's work with Jay. Because we knew Jay really wanted, and let's record in LA instead of Nashville, which we did. And we recorded at an amazing studio called Sphere Studios on the old Motown desk.
Really?
Yeah, old Neve Motown desk that was in the Motown studio in LA in the 70s. So all the songs that were recorded on that, for me, that was just like that was a good vibe right out the gate. So we were in there, and Jay's got a different way of recording where he likes to do a song a day, and we never recorded that way before. But it really,
everything from top to bottom.
Yeah. So you drums, bass, guitars, solos, vocals, next song. Instead of 10 drum tracks, 10 bass tracks, 10, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we never worked that way. And it worked really well for us. We were just able to focus, I thought, really great on every song. And I really enjoyed recording that way. And Jay was just amazing to work with. Great, great vibe. Really chilled. I had an amazing time. I mean, I've said this and I'll go on record saying this. I've been blessed to be making records for 30 years. That's the best time I've ever had making a record in my life. You know, it was so much fun.
Rock
didn't want
roll.
It to end, you know? Yeah.
Fucking A, man.
Yeah.
Are you still living in LA? Is LA still home?
Yeah, 15 years.
How are you finding it?
Hey, you know.
Good and bad?
Yes.
You got kids as well, right?
You got kids,
a family, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I live in a very nice part of Los Angeles. The weather's beautiful. My kids go to a great school. I feel my family's very safe where we are. As a husband and a father and a family man, you can't really ask for much more than that, you know. So that's the main things for me. I could live anywhere as long as I have that criteria, you know, and there's an airport, you know. And it's just nice to see the kids. I've got great opportunities, certainly opportunities that I never had when I was a kid. So it's nice for them, you know.
How old are they?
My youngest is about to turn 12. My eldest is 22, and she's in Berlin. And,
nice, great
already,
city.
Great city already. Off
is she an artist or a musician? Or
she's not. No, she's still at university. She's doing media studies.
Right,
I have two stepchildren. I have a 19-year-old daughter that still lives with us, who is an artist, who's an amazing artist, and doing really well. And then I have a stepson who's in Vegas, and he works as a lifeguard at one of the casinos down there.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So I've just got the two girls at home right now: the 12-year-old and the 19-year-old.
So you got your hands full, man, and still you find all this time to write and record and. Are you doing solo stuff still as well?
Yeah, so I've solo album's done.
Right.
It's recorded.
What number is this, 5? This
will be solo album number 5. I did it with Keith Nelson. Keith used to be in Buckcherry. Keith produced it and co-wrote it with me. Full band album. I had Keith and myself playing guitar. Xavier used to be a drummer in Buckcherry playing drums, and Robert Crane from Black Star Riders playing bass on it. So it's done. It's in the can, sitting waiting on it. As soon as the Black Star Riders is done with this, I will put it out. So it probably won't come out till 2021 because I'd like to tour it a little bit as well. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm blessed to be able to do what I do. The ideas keep coming.
The inspiration. Does the well never run dry? That's a lucky situation, right? Some people find that.
I just think there's so much going on.
The writer's block can come from out of nowhere, and then. But yeah, I guess if you're someone who's, you know, comes from that school of punk, perhaps, even though the sound isn't necessarily always that.
Yeah.
It's a reaction to the world around you, right?
And yeah, it is. And there's just so much stuff going on, and I just never seem to be stuck for stuff to write about. I mean, I may have written about the same subject a couple of times, but I think after 30 years, you're allowed to do that as long as it's different each time. But I just love it. I just enjoy what I do immensely. And it's a job, and I treat it like a job. I mean, I treat it with the respect that I think it deserves. Like, I get up in the morning when I'm home at 6:30, get the kids out the door, go to the gym for an hour and a half. I'll get a lot of ideas when I'm in the gym, come back, pick up the guitar, know I've got that 4-hour window until the kids come home from school, and then, you know, then it's chaos, you know, dinner time and homework. But I've got that 4-hour window, and that's what I do every day, 4 or 5 hours. And I'll be, you know, like everybody else, I'll be doing messages in that time, going, you know, picking groceries up or stuff for my wife, because my wife works full time as well. But we just make it work, you know.
That's... Do you still cut loose on the road? Or do you live a cleaner, saner life these days?
I'm pretty clean and boring these days. Yeah. You know? I like to.
You've had your fun.
I like to smoke a little bit of weed now and again, you know, just to take the edge off. I like the odd beer now and again, but yeah, compared to what I used to be like. And because we still tour so much.
Yeah, you want to be on point.
I want to look after myself, and I want to enjoy it, and I want to be fit, and I want to be healthy, and I don't want to lose my voice. I'm very conscious of that. Because if you're hungover, or you feel like shit, or you're sick, you're not enjoying it, and then what's the point in doing it? You're letting yourself down, you're letting down all the people who paid the money to come and see you. And it works for me. Everybody's different, but I've got a regime that I feel works really well for me, and I like to stick to it, you know.
Tell me about touring with Pantera as we approach the end of the conversation. Did you do 7 weeks?
We did, in Europe.
At what year?
94.
Wow.
Vulgar Display of Power.
Fuck. So they're just on fire at that point.
Yeah, you know, that was a weird tour, sadly, for us. One of the tours that I thought was going to be amazing and looking forward to it so much, and it wasn't. We'd met those guys we did a show together in New York City when Cowboys from Hell came out. Right before they'd taken off and before we played the Cat Club in New York together, and we'd become friends, and I'd hung out with Phil when he'd been in London a couple of times as a mate, come to the shows, and we'd gone to see, I think we went to see Megadeth together one night. So we're like, great, we're going on tour with our friends. And when the tour started, they were very standoffish, and in 7 weeks we didn't get one sound check. And we were treated very much like the British band, because Downset were on that tour as well. They were first on. We were in the middle in Pantera, and Phil was great, and just Vinny was very aloof. And it wasn't sort of till later, I think, that there was a lot of problems in the camp. I think that's when a lot of the problems had started for them. So I think they were dealing with a lot of stuff. So maybe we read more into it and took it personally when it wasn't. But just we'd been used to being on tour with bands that have been amazing to us.
Yeah, and treated you really well.
So maybe we were expecting too much, because we've been spoiled before. So looking back, maybe it was just us that overreacted. But I never felt like we were very welcome on that tour. We went down great. We went down okay, you know, because we just put out Crank, which was a heavy as fuck album. So we went down fine in the shows. But it was just a strange tour. And I just came off it going, that wasn't what I thought it was going to be. You know, I couldn't quite say why, you know. And it's funny. And I saw Vinny about 10 days before he passed. We played in Vegas with Judas Priest at a festival, Black Star Riders. And I went out in the crowd to watch Priest. And I looked over on my left and Vinny was just standing there. And I went over and shook his hand. I was like, hey, Vin, I haven't seen you in a while. And, you know, how you doing? And he was like, cool. And that was it. And, you know, 10 days later, the poor guy's dead, you know.
That's such a shocking,
yeah. But
it was just a weird tour,
you know. It was one of those tours where I'd like to say it was everything I thought it was going to be, but it wasn't, you know.
Did something happen in Brixton backstage, though?
Andy Cairns. Maybe this is the reason you've just reminded me of it. I don't know if it was. Me and Andy had been out in a rip all day, and Andy was on form, and we went backstage in to see Phil, and Phil kind of had his entourage and all that. And don't Phil, Phil's never been nothing but a great guy to me, and I've always got on with him great. But Andy just took over the room, and I was just even sitting going, fuck's sake, Andy. Like, he was just on fire being Andy Cairns and having this whole room in the palm of his hand. And these guys were just like, I think they were kind of frightened of him, because here's this Irish guy in full flow, you know, just jumping around the room, cracking jokes, not taking any shit, blah, blah, blah. And everybody was just kind of, I was dying with laughter, you know. And I think they didn't really know what had hit them. I think they'd never seen anything like it in their life. They thought, is this guy a terrorist? What's he going to do, you know? You know, and it was just Andy Cairns being Andy on total form, you know. So maybe that's why we get treated a bit weird. There you go. I'd forgotten
He's
about
to blame
that.
For everything.
I'd forgotten about that, you know.
Ricky, man, have you got a book out?
No.
You need to do a book, man.
Thank you. I'm going to do.
Is it something you thought about doing?
I have, but there's a whole lot of stories I think still to put in it. I think thankfully I'm still making them. So I think I'll put the book on hold for hopefully another 10 years.
That's going to be one hell of a read, though.
Yeah, thank you. No, there's a lot of good stuff in there, you know. I'm quite proud of, I always talk about the carnage that we created with the Almighty, and we wear off the scale and sick and a lot of stuff I've done. It was always very creative, and none of it was, we always were very respectful of people and places, and we weren't dicks.
It wasn't like the dirt.
No, we weren't just dicks. We certainly had a lot of fun. I had a lot of carnage, but it was very respectful, creative carnage. I'm very, very proud of that fact. If there is such a thing, and there is, because we did it, you know.
My final question, mate, is tomorrow in here, I'm chatting to your old friend, Justin Sullivan, and you guys played in Berlin with Bowie, right? Was that when you were in the band for that brief stint?
That was my second show.
That was your second show with New Model Army. Yeah. First, obviously, proper band you're in.
Yeah.
First, tell us about that, and then we'll end on that.
You know, I was in a little punk band, and New Model Army's management were interested in us, taking us on, and they gave us some dates in New Model Army. Justin found out I was a huge fan of New Model Army, asked me up on stage to play on a couple of songs that he felt needed an extra guitar on. One was Master Race off Ghost of Cain, the other one was 51st Date. And I guess he liked me. I was in awe of them. They had a world tour coming up. They needed an extra musician. I got asked to do it, no brainer. And that's it. And I was texting with Justin last week because he sent me the new album.
So
which
good.
Which I think is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I texted him back, and talking to which, tell him, I've sent him the Blackstar Riders one. He hasn't replied
really?
Yet.
I'll so call him up on that.
Call him up on that. But he's been a friend and a mentor ever since. And I learned so, I was only in that band for a year, but I learned so much about stagecraft, songwriting, attitude, standing up for yourself, believing in yourself, not playing the game, getting things done in your terms from that guy in those 12 months. And I really learned so much from him. So I'm always indebted to him. Always loved the band. I think the band are phenomenal. I think he's a very underrated songwriter, criminally underrated songwriter. But, you know, he's just fantastic. And like I said, the new album's amazing. Yeah.
And with Bowie in Berlin.
Oh, yes.
Just to end on that.
Second gig, yeah. So I fly over. The first gig's Hamburg Docks, which is a great gig, and it's amazing. And the second gig's 85,000 people in Berlin in front of the Reichstag. And the wall's still up. The wall's still behind the, you know, so there's people on the other side of the wall going crazy as well. Surreal. Absolutely surreal. Boy walks in the dressing room. You know. 2 weeks later, I was feeding chickens on my dad. Earlier, I was feeding chickens on my dad's farm. You know, and here I am. You know, and it's just mind blowing. It was great. And like I said, I was only in the band for a year, but I had a great time. It was really was amazing.
The start of an amazing story that's still very much in full effect, my friend.
Yep.
Thanks for coming on the show. I really enjoyed chatting to you.
Oh mate, it was brilliant.
Cheers.
Thank
Loved
you
it.
So much.
I'm going to have a little bit of lunch, and then I'm going to chat to your boy Scott.
Yeah, that, look forward to that.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.